This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, the challenging present and intriguing future of air travel. If you had your Thanksgiving turkey on one of the coasts or hundreds of miles away from here, chances are you gritted your teeth, you eliminated all gels, sprays, and flammables from your carry-on, and you boarded a plane. And if things went well, minor delays, on-time arrivals, you might have been reaping the results of a decision that President Bush made to open military air corridors to commercial plane traffic over Thanksgiving. He'll do it again at Christmas. It's one of the ways that the administration and the FAA are trying to relieve airline congestion. New runway openings at some of the busiest airports in the country are helping, too. But throw one snowstorm into the mix and air travel for much of the country can grind to a halt. So what would it take to manage our skies better? Is it new technology? Is it more airspace? Is it better air traffic control in hubs like New York and Chicago? We're going to talk about that for the first half of the hour with our guests. In the second half, we're going to turn to the planes of the future. Our guest predicts that by 2030, we could be jetting between cities and countries on an aircraft that resembles from the outside a B-2 stealth bomber, and that's 30 to 40% more fuel efficient. More on that a little bit later. But first to our guest for the first half of our conversation. Edward Faberman is executive director of the Air Carrier Association of America, which represents low-fare carriers, and he's with us this morning from Washington. Mr. Faberman, good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Clinton Oster is with us as well. He's a professor of public and environmental affairs at Indiana University. His most recent book is titled Managing the Skies, and he's with us this morning from Bloomington, Indiana. And Professor Oster, good to have you here.
Good morning.
Edward Faberman, I'm going to start with you. How much of a difference does it really make when the president opens up military airspace to commercial traffic and we get a few more runways that come online at some of these major airports? Could we really see the difference over Thanksgiving?
Well, it makes a difference opening the airspace in certain areas of the country, but of course those are the areas that have the worst delays right now. The New England, New York, Mideast areas of the country, for example, those are areas where when you open the airspace, it does make a difference. The runways certainly, the runways are good and bad news. I mean, certainly good news in the sense that a place like Chicago O'Hare is going to have fewer delays. On the other hand, it's also likely to increase the number of flights that are taking place at Chicago. So in the long run, it may balance out. But opening the airspace and providing other ways for aircraft to get around is a helpful thing.
And tell me, I don't think we had major snowstorms that I read about over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. As holiday week travel weekends go, how would you assess this last one that we've just come through?
Well, we did have some major storms. They weren't necessarily blizzards, but certainly there were some significant delays at major airports. I will say two things. Number one, I think the government did a lot of things to improve the system. That includes TSA and, fully staffing their security checkpoints and everything. So there were fewer delays, people getting through. And there were also, don't forget, airlines cut back about between 5 and 10% of their flights. So that was another factor that improved things, as did the airspace changes.
Professor Oster, let's talk about the congestion, and I wonder what you think the key factor is to the kind of congestion that we see. Is it outdated equipment? Is it an antiquated system? Is it air traffic control systems that really don't work? What is it?
Well, it's certainly the case that our air traffic control system is really outdated and is probably not up to the standards that we're seeing in some other countries of the world. So to the extent that we could improve the air traffic control system, that might give us a little bit more capacity in some of the terminal airspace. In other words, the airspace around some of these major airports, and that would help a little bit. But we still have a situation where in the New York area, for example, where we've got an awful lot of congestion, We're not likely to be able to add runways at airports like LaGuardia or even Newark.
So when you have congestion in an area like that, which can create a ripple effect, as we know here in the middle of the country, you know, throughout the whole system, what is it then? Just too many planes trying to come in a limited amount of time, or what?
I think that's certainly part of it. And as Ed mentioned, we got a little bit of a break, I think, over this last holiday because of some of the capacity cutbacks that we've seen in the airlines, and that helps. But those cutbacks are not likely to persist forever. I mean, as the economy recovers in the future, we're going to see continued growth. I think we may have to see maybe a little bit reallocation of the size aircraft going in. We could certainly move more people in and out of the New York area if we were operating somewhat larger aircraft and maybe fewer of the smaller regional jets. And I think that's likely to happen in the future. It's just likely to get to the point where it's just not economically attractive to operate these small aircraft in and out of these highly congested airports.
Edward Faberman, that's not good news to you, is it? Because you represent these smaller carriers.
No, when the word smaller doesn't mean the size of aircraft they fly. The word smaller means that, you know, they're not the largest carriers in the country. Professor Oster is 100% correct. What we have seen in New York, for example, and even Chicago to some extent, and other major markets, is the number of regional jets that are flying in and out have grown significantly. And as a result, there's really three end results. Number one, it slows the system down. Number two, it blocks larger aircraft and often competitors from coming into airports. And number three, it significantly impacts the amount of funds that are now going to airports and the federal government through landing fees, ticket taxes, and PFC taxes that are on tickets.
Tell me who's flying all these smaller planes that you're both talking about.
It's the nation's largest carriers.
Huh.
In many cases, for example, and I just use this as an example, American Airlines has been operating a shuttle flights from New York to LaGuardia to Boston, and for many years those flights only held 35, 40 people.
Huh. Wow.
And we're certainly not opposed, and we support service to small communities, essential air service communities, but a lot of these flights now are going between large markets. In some cases, they've been thrown in to keep others out.
I see. As probably happens here.
That happens there, yes.
The Northwest hub, soon to be Delta. Professor Oster, a quick question about this before we take some calls. I think I hear you both saying then it is incumbent on the airlines to manage their operations better if they want to control some of this congestion, which would benefit them as well, right?
Well, it does. But part of the problem is that if one airline tends to try to manage its operations, for example, by substituting, you know, one larger jet flight for two or three regional jet flights, that may simply open the door for other airlines to take some of those additional slots and put more aircraft in there. And I, you know, Ed is certainly correct in terms of the use of regional jets in larger markets. I had to fly to Washington Sunday evening. And I flew on a small regional jet. That regional jet came out of LaGuardia to fly to Indianapolis, and then I took it from Indianapolis to Washington.
Yeah, that seems crazy, doesn't
and
it?
And virtually all of our Indianapolis-Washington service now is in regional jets. Both U.S. Airways and Northwest have their regional affiliates operating those. Now, from a convenience standpoint, it gives me more flights to choose from, but it's probably not a very efficient use of congested airspace to be flying in, 40 to 50 seat regional jets.
Clinton Oster is one of our guests this morning. He's professor of public and environmental affairs at Indiana University. Most recent book titled Managing the Skies. And Edward Faberman is with us. He's executive director of the Air Carrier Association of America. They represent low fare carriers. To the phones here, if you'd like to join the conversation, some perspective on this, some experience with this, some questions about it, we'd like to hear it. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the Metro, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828 as we talk about congestion and how to solve it in the skies. 651-227-6000 online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. Second half of this conversation, we'll be talking about how we will be flying in the future. It's an interesting picture. To the phones here to Jim in Minneapolis. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Carrie.
Hey, your question.
With regard to efficiency, I'm a retired airline pilot, and I can tell you running 35 round-trip flights between Minneapolis and Chicago is filling the airspace with a lot of pollution, and we could have high-speed trains like they have in Europe and be running down to Chicago through Madison, perhaps, at 200 miles an hour with a lot more efficiency.
Yeah. There's Edward Faberman, there's a good example, I think, of what you've both been talking about, these trips between Chicago and Minneapolis and the feeling by the airlines that they want to kind of own those routes so that others don't come into them.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly agree with the professor that, you know, it's nice to be able to say, oh, I can fly 6, 7, 8, 9 times a day. On the other hand, having 4 or 5 flights a day when congestion is improved and the system is getting more funding and everything else, I think benefits everyone. Let me just tell you something. We're talking about the history of some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just read a quick statement. Throughout the year, there were strong indications that the airport and airway system were on the verge of saturation, particularly in Chicago, New York, and Washington areas. Flight delays were far beyond mere annoyance and inconvenience. That statement was made in 1968.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
it hasn't changed.
It just goes to show you that, yes, we've seen some improvements, but we do need to have long-term and short-term technical and other improvements.
And Professor Oster, I was reading what you have written about how things are done in Canada and Australia and New Zealand, and these are what, potential models for the United States to look at? Why?
Well, those countries organize their air traffic control a little bit differently, and in particular, they seem to have a little bit more direct accountability. One of the challenges that FAA faces is the accountability is pretty diffused among DOT, the administration, the House, and the Senate.
Mm.
And so you don't have clear lines of authority, and you don't have as close a connection between the users of the system, meaning the airlines and business aviation and general aviation, and the people providing the system. So whereas in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and to some extent even the UK, they really do a better job of having user input into the system and having a system where you can make more predictable kinds of investments, where you've got the revenue coming in to support the system more closely tied to the costs that are imposed on the system. There's a whole host of ways that those countries have in recent years changed their operations, and I think we need to take a pretty close look at what some of those countries are doing, and there may well be some good lessons for us from those countries.
Professor, when you say more accountable, make the FAA more accountable, specifically what do you mean?
Well, in some sense, it's almost allow the FAA to be more accountable in that the FAA doesn't really have historically hasn't really had that much control over some of their decisions. For example, when they've wanted to improve their efficiency by consolidating some of their operations into a smaller number of centers and the like, they've been blocked by Congress, whose concern are more how many jobs might we lose in my district. And the number of jobs is phenomenally small that would be lost, but nevertheless, that's been enough to block them. So from time to time, there have been a variety of ways in which FAA really has had their hands tied in terms of making improvements that they've recognized and would like to make. And so that's what I mean by diffused accountability. I'm not trying to be critical of the FAA for not being responsible. It's that they're not in an environment where they're allowed to be responsible.
Ed Faberman, would organizations such as yours support something like that?
Well, I certainly think that dialogue is critical. I think sitting down together is important. And I think historically, you know, things like that were done. And I think we need to go back and look at those options and push those options.
You're being very diplomatic. What's the concern among the air carriers association like yours and some of the others about this?
Well, I mean, the concern is that, you know, it's like saying, you know, we can't open another coffee shop downtown, and you know, I'm not sure that, you know, the Starbucks or the other dominant coffee shops are going to be going to the table saying, oh, no, we'll give up 5 or 6 and others can move in. I think that you have to hear the dialogue, but then the government has to step up to the plate and say, okay, we're now going to take the necessary action.
Well, wouldn't that be the FAA, Professor Oster is saying, being more accountable?
It's the FAA and the Department of Transportation. And, you know, we have not seen those kind of decisions being made, you know, recently.
Okay, to the phones, to Dan in Minneapolis. Hi, Dan.
Hi, I'm an air traffic controller.
Oh, I'm glad you called.
Here. Thank you. And I'm just wondering what your guests have to say about the congestion being based on the physical limitations of the airspace system versus the controller workforce being weakened over the past couple of years.
What do you mean when you say the airspace issue specifically?
The airspace issue being, you know, how many planes can fit in a given square mile of airspace.
Okay.
It seems to me, and I haven't worked at a busy airport like JFK or LaGuardia or anything, but it just seems to me that I can fit a bunch of airplanes in a small area if I need to, but there often isn't the required staffing to do such things.
Professor Oster, how does that figure into what we're talking about today?
Well, I think there's two kinds of questions, and one of them comes down to, I think, giving the air traffic control system better equipment to work with. There's certainly some staffing questions, and you know, we're seeing the diffused impact from the air traffic controller strike and subsequent firings back in 1981. A bunch of controllers were brought into the system at that point, and those folks are reaching retirement age now. And so the FAA is in the process of trying to hire and train a bunch of new controllers, and there's certainly some growing pains in that. But I think the other question is can we give the air traffic controllers better equipment?
Yeah.
Can we give them equipment that allows them to know a little bit more precisely where those aircraft are?
Why is that so difficult? We've had conversations about this before. I don't understand why we're still talking about this years later.
It's a question of how you go about it, and some of these things certainly cost money. I think that the philosophy that FAA has often used is sort of one of saying, okay, we're going to make a big, massive new system. We're going to, in some sense, to use a baseball analogy, we're going to hit a home run here. And,
mm-hmm.
and I think if you look at the approach that places like NAV Canada and NATS in the UK and Air Services Australia, they tend to make more frequent incremental changes. They also tend to have the air traffic controllers much more heavily involved in the design of these changes.
Which really makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, it does to me, because I think, you know, the air traffic control system has to operate with an incredible degree of reliability, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And a system that makes smaller incremental changes, I think, is often easier to maintain that reliability than a system that's making large sweeping changes at one point in time, or at least that's been the philosophy of most of the other air traffic control organizations.
Let me take another call here from Cheryl in Eden Prairie. Cheryl, thanks for waiting. Your question for us.
Well, that's just exactly what my question was. During Thanksgiving, somebody said that they're still using cathode ray tubes for equipment.
In air control towers?
And so I was wondering, what's the history of the upgrades that they've been doing?
Ed Faberman, do you know?
Well, I mean, it's unfortunate, but remember the system you have to go through. This is not a corporation that can make board decisions and you know, assign financing. It's a system where the FAA needs to go to the Department of Transportation, that needs to go to the administration and the White House, and needs to you know, ask for the funding and then go to Congress and put a proposal on the table. And it's a complicated process, and it's often delayed. And this time around, with the next generation equipment being talked about, it's been very problematical because, you know, they continue to debate, do we want a system in 5 years or can we wait 7 years and get the best possible system?
Oh.
But I certainly, you know, agree with the professor that we need to do incremental changes. We need to put as much in place this year, and that includes staffing. If there are staffing issues at any facility, we need to address those. But we need to improve the system while we're looking at the long-term solutions and not say, well, we're going to put it on hold until we come up with the perfect system for down the road.
Professor, Cheryl specifically mentioned cathode ray tubes still being used. Is that true?
Well, I think we've actually phased out vacuum tubes now, which the FAA was the last known purchaser of vacuum tubes. But some of the displays that are being used are not the most modern displays, and some of the computer technology that's being used is not the most modern technology, and I think that's really a problem.
Of course, all it would take would be some major plane crash where the problem, you know, was sourced back to air traffic control, which I know is a terrible thing to think about, but then there would be, I mean, just like when the bridge collapsed here in Minneapolis, then there would be all this urgency around making updates.
Right, but it's still making updates, and particularly large updates, is still a tricky business because we have to be able to maintain the operation of the system continuously. We can't just say, okay, guys, we're going to shut down for an hour now and transition to the new system.
I see.
And so it is a challenge, and I think that's one of the reasons that making a series of smaller incremental steps has been pretty successful in other countries. And you know, I have as I think we all do, an enormous amount of respect for the air traffic controller workforce. I just like to give them better tools to work with.
Ed Faberman online here from Steve in Cottonwood, Minnesota asks, is any major airline considering the use of slower but cheaper and more fuel efficient turboprops in the future? Do you know?
I would say the answer to that at this point is no, because and if anything, they are going, you know, they're going to larger aircraft. Now, certainly there are some markets where that could be something that would be looked at, but those would not be the Chicago's, the New York's, the Minneapolis's. You know, those would be small markets. But I think because of the cost, and even though we're all applauding because fuel is down, we recognize it could go up. But if you look at the cost that the industry was hit with early this year, operating a 30-seat or a 35-seat turboprop would be extremely costly.
You mean when oil was up?
Yes.
Before it came down?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Steve, I hope you'll listen into the second half of our conversation here, because we are going to talk about what air travel is going to look like, well, as predicted now, in the year 2030 and beyond. To the phones, to Chester in St. Francis. Hi, Chester.
How do you do?
Okay.
Are the smaller planes paying their fair share of the cost of the system? It appears that they're heavily subsidized. Anoka County is just putting over $20 million into their small airport.
Ed
Faberman, who is going to pay for this?
Yeah, Ed Faberman, why don't you tackle that?
Yes, well, the answer is they do not pay their fair share. And let me explain why. First of all, every plane that lands at an airport pays a landing fee based upon the weight of the plane. So if you have a 30-seat as opposed to 120-seat, the airport is getting significantly less funding. So that impacts the airport's ability to do things to improve their facility, and it also requires them to get more money from the government. Secondly, there are two fees that right now apply to every ticket. One is a passenger facility charge, which goes to the airports. And by the way, the airports are saying, because we're not getting enough out of these fees, we want them increased. And then there's an excise tax that gets added on to the all ticket. So if you have 30 people buying tickets versus 100 on a larger plane, you're getting a lot less money. And that's the problem. If you're flying, you know, between Indianapolis and LaGuardia or National, and you have 30 people on the plane, imagine how much more money the government could get if you had 70 people or 80 people on the plane. And all of this funding will help expand and improve the system. So it is being subsidized. And yes, there are some routes, some small communities that We understand that that's the role of the government. But when you're flying between major markets, steps must be taken to increase the size of aircraft in those markets.
Professor Oster, we've talked a bit this morning about how the airlines could be taking a look at their schedules and maybe rejiggering the schedule to see that so many flights are not coming into the same hub. I'm also curious whether you think as new momentum comes in on global warming with the Obama administration, we hear Congress talking about putting legislation together, whether the airlines are going to be a part of that and really feel the pressure to not just be more fuel efficient, but also to emit less pollution.
There's no question. And in fact, that pressure is already on the airlines in Europe.
How's it manifesting itself there?
Well, we don't know yet. It's because the Europeans have only very recently decided to include the airlines in their cap and trade system. There's some legal issues, but there's no question that the airframe industry, the Boeings and Airbuses and Embraers and those folks in the world are certainly looking to figure out ways to improve their fuel efficiency. And I think this is probably going to be another force toward larger aircraft because from an emissions standpoint, and if we think about it as an emissions per passenger, larger aircraft are going to have an advantage there over the smaller aircraft.
But, you know,
I
think our guest the next half of this conversation is going to tell us that the next generation, not the second to the next generation, but the next generation of planes coming are not going to be that much more fuel efficient, and they're not going to be that much less emission emitting.
It's certainly true that you know they're pushing the technology. We're also, I think, where that technology may go a little bit more is we may look a little bit more at alternate fuels. There have already been some test flights on alternate fuels, and you know he's should that be what he says. It's certainly true that while the industry has made enormous progress over the last 20 years in fuel efficiency, the more you improve it, the harder the next improvements are to make. And so it's going to be a real challenge. There's no question about that.
Ed Faberman, Clinton Oster, thank you very much for an interesting conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ed Faberman, Executive Director of the Air Carriers Association of America, Clinton Oster, Professor of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. And his most recent book is called Managing the Skies. We're going to take a break for news. On the other side of news, Clive Irving is going to be with us, wrote a very interesting piece for Condé Nast Traveler that I spotted about how we will travel, he imagines, in the year 2030 and beyond. We'll talk about how the shape of these airliners will change and why, and what this idea of a blended wing concept is and how that fits in to new designs. 800-242-2828 to join us, 651-227-6000. And if you're online this morning, you can join the conversation by going to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and clicking on Send a Question. Back in just a moment to the newsroom and Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Stocks are falling again in early trade amid more evidence of a weak economy. The Labor Department says productivity rose at an annual rate of 1.3% in the third quarter. That is down from 3.6% in the previous 3 months. The president of General Motors says if GM went bankrupt, it would further erode confidence in the company. Fritz Henderson says GM is ready to take a host of steps as part of a bailout the big three automakers hope to get from Congress. President-elect Barack Obama today named New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson as his choice for Secretary of Commerce. Richardson, who had been a presidential candidate, had been mentioned for Secretary of State, but that job went to Hillary Clinton. 2 8-pound bombs, said to be left over from last week's terrorist attacks in India, have been found in Mumbai's train station. Police say they were defused. It's not clear why they weren't found until today. The Indian military has been told to watch for more attacks. In fewer than 5 years, electric cars could be a major part of the traffic on Hawaiian highways. Hawaii plans to become the first state with electric car stations statewide. A California company says it will build up to 1,000 charged spots. Carver County prosecutors have charged a 73-year-old man with 2 misdemeanors in the May death of a road construction flagman in what was U.S. 212. Llewellyn Kettner was allegedly driving a vehicle that struck and killed 47-year-old Leo Queasley of Stewartville. At the time of the accident, prosecutors say the flagman was trying to control traffic as a large bulldozer was crossing the road. Since the accident, that section of highway has been renamed Highway 61. MnDOT says Queasley was the 31st agency employee to be killed in a work zone since 1960. Partly to mostly cloudy skies for this day today. Scattered flurries, highs of 15 in the north, 25 in the south. Right now in the Twin Cities, temperature 17 under partly sunny skies. It's 9:35. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
A lot of things that people say don't make much sense when you take them out of context.
The outdoors don't get naked and smear themselves in chocolate.
I'm Kathy Werzer, regional host of Morning Edition here on Minnesota Public Radio News. Our job each day is to sort through the information and events and ideas that are swirling in our world and put them into context for you. Listen weekday mornings from 4 to 9 and online at minnesotapublicradio.org.
Support for this program comes from the agency formerly known as Kirker, now Preston Kelly, an independent agency committed to using the power of iconic ideas to tie advertising, interactive, street, and relationship marketing together. More at PrestonKelly.com.
Today's programming is supported by Grave 601 Hotel and Cosmos Restaurant. Ballrooms, meeting rooms, and suites are now available for holiday celebrations with friends, family, and colleagues. Details at Grave601Hotel.com.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, neuroscientist and musician Daniel Levitin is going to be with us. He's written a new book called The World in Six Songs. He does fascinating research, and he has this very interesting argument about how music shaped the way our brains evolved. We're also going to listen to a lot of music, music that's meaningful to Daniel Levitin and that he thinks demonstrates this idea that there are six kinds of songs that were very instrumental in the way the brain works. So we'll talk about that at 10 o'clock. I hope you're with us for that tomorrow morning at 9. The recession, now that it has been officially declared, how's it going to compare to other recessions? What do you need to know to weather this recession? Sandy Block, she's a columnist about money for a national newspaper, is going to be with us for part of that conversation. That's tomorrow at 9. Back to what we're talking about this morning, which is crowding and congestion in airspace, at airports, on airlines. But we also wanted to look ahead to the way we will travel, 25, 30 years from now and beyond. Clive Irving is with us. He's a senior consulting editor and travel writer for Condé Nast Traveler magazine. Clive, good to have you here.
Good morning. I was listening to what your previous guest was saying towards the end, and it's very interesting because it neatly dovetails with what I'd like to say, which is that you really look at the future of flight in two steps. The next step is not the most radical one. And then the step after that will be very radical, I think, which is what I wrote about in Condé Nast Traveler. But as your previous guest was saying, that major concerns at the moment are intercity connections in the domestic market. And there's an interesting game of poker going on between Airbus and Boeing, in that they both have to find replacements for the planes that most of us fly on all the time, the Boeing 737 and the Airbus A320, by the year 2020. And they're desperately waiting until the last minute to see if there's some silver bullet in terms of technology that they can apply to these planes to make them much cleaner in terms of emission.
You think there will be?
No, I think they've squeezed almost every possible advance out of the technology for a conventional airplane. There will be advances in fuel consumption and a certain amount of advances in aerodynamics, but basically the biggest hope for more efficiency in that generation will be in new fuels, in things that, for example, I wrote about in the magazine, algae, as a possible source for fuel because it has great attributes. And unlike other biofuels, it doesn't raid the larder of food supplies, and it can be produced in a very economical way and can produce a fuel that burns with far lower CO2 emissions.
Let me mention to our listeners that if you'd like to read the article that we're going to talk with Clive Irving about here from the Condé Nast Traveler, you can find a link to it on the Mid-Morning page. Here's the interesting thing. The illustrations and the photographs of the next generation of plane travel, really interesting. So it's worth a look at the article. Go to the Mid-Morning page. You'll find a link for it, and you can see the photographs and the illustrations and then read the article that we're going to be talking about. Clive, tell me a little bit about the design that is being worked on, this idea of a prototype.
Yes, well,
some of these companies.
Both Airbus and Boeing are looking at this form called the blended wing. Now, basically what it is they've removed the fuselage from the plane, the part that we all sit in, the tube, and made it into one big bat-shaped type wing, which is far more efficient because in a conventional plane, the wings do all the work and the fuselage is dead weight, which is carried around by the wings. By removing the fuselage and sitting us all basically inside this arrow-shaped wing, the plane becomes instantly 30% more aerodynamically efficient, and that's a huge gain. And I don't know of any other configuration that can give you a gain of that dimension. Of course, for passengers, it would be a very big change, as our graphic shows, that you would have no windows at the end of the rows, because basically you'd be sitting in a space like a theater with rows as many as 30 seats wide. Or you would have a promenade deck at the front that you could walk around and look out, see where you're going, rather than looking out the window to see where you've been.
Well, and as somebody pointed out to you in the article, there is concern about eliminating the windows at each seat, but someone else said to you, look, people are reading and now they're watching videos, and they don't think that would be a really big deal to eliminate the windows.
No, I don't. I think, honestly, though, there is a psychological adjustment for passengers to make, walking into a plane that no longer resembles a submarine and, in fact, resembles a theater. And in one sense, it's a life-enhancing experience, I think, to walk into an auditorium rather than a tube. It's not claustrophobic. But, of course, any change as radical as this from what people have become accustomed to something so different, will take an adjustment on the part of passengers. But it brings so many advantages with it.
Yeah. You describe the engines that would power this plane as jet engines stripped of their outer casing to reveal what are called open rotors. All major engine makers are working on this concept. Why?
Well, that's fascinating, because it will look as though you've reverted back to propellers, basically, because they do resemble a sort of marriage of a jet engine and propellers. The propellers, in this case, are these open rotors, two rows of them at the back of the engine. And that's a much more aerodynamically efficient form of propulsion. Again, they're promising a 30% improvement in fuel efficiency, which is terrific, and you can't easily pass that up. And the fact that people like Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce and General Electric are all looking at this form of engine indicates that it shows enormous promise.
Just talk about you write about the climate control and you write about the seating in this new plane. They're very individualistic. I mean, you no longer have to deal with what everybody else wants the temperature to be, right?
Well, no, I at Boeing, they showed me some of their future works in the wonderful place they've got where they work on all this stuff. And essentially what's going to happen to your seat in the plane is it's going to become a digital entertainment center. And you'll have, apart from the joys of climate control and controlling your own lighting, you'll have a wide screen with high-definition television, probably live television coming into the plane, or a touchscreen email. You'll be able to check your emails, and you'll have movies and TV and music, all in the same form as, say, an iPod, very personal to you. And that's a huge advantage in the way that you can be distracted from the actual act of flying.
Clive Irving is with us here as we talk about the future of air travel. Spent the first half of this conversation talking about the congestion and the crowding, but what will air travel be like 25 or 30 years from now? Condé Nast Traveler had a feature piece on this, complete with illustrations and photographs of prototypes. And Clive has written about the fuels that these future planes will use and the design, which is this blended wing design that we're talking about this morning. You want to read the article, you want to see some of the illustrations, you can do that at a link on the mid-morning page.
By the way, you can also on our website, you can also see a video of the prototype of this plane being flown, which I give a comment.
Oh, that's cool.
Commentary to it is very cool. So you actually see the physical thing, not just the graphic in the magazine. You see it being flown at Edwards Air Force Base in California.
We've got a link to the video as well, I'm told. So let me put the number out here if any of our listeners want to join in. 800-242-2828. In the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online today, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. If you're online, check out those photographs and let us know what you think. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Is it true that initially when you started to report on this piece that Boeing did not want you to to get into too much detail about.
Well, they didn't know, and there's a lot of trade secrets involved in this, because we know that Airbus are working on the same idea too. But this is more visible, the Boeing thing. It was actually being flown in this test plane in California, and they wouldn't actually let me go to California to see it being test flown, although you could park a car at the end of the airstrip, I guess, and watch it. But I found out that this thing had actually been devised and created in England, and I tracked down the guys who'd done it. It was actually a very clever professor at an aeronautical college who'd had his students work on this project for 2 years, and it so happened that Boeing and NASA had a project for the same thing, which, of course, being a NASA project, was way over budget and went belly up at the very moment that this guy from England turned up and said, I think you guys should look at what we've done. And that was the first time in history that Boeing had bought a plane concept from somebody else.
Clive, do you think in the end, even though there is competition between these two airplane manufacturers, that they will come out with a similar design, because this is where design's headed?
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing that all design the planes lead you to the same place in the end, because the laws of aerodynamics and airplane manufacture mean that everybody's planes turn out looking very much like everybody else's. And so if there's a gain of this kind, of this dimension, there are other forms being looked at which promise some advantages, but nothing quite as good as this strange batwing looking plane.
You know, I described it earlier as it does, and you do kind of this evolution of airplane design. It looks more like a military B-2 bomber than it does what we fly in today.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating, too, because the genealogy of the evolution of the jet airliner came straight from a bomber, from the B-47, and that evolved into the 707, which became then the standard shape for jet airliners for 50 years. And at a similar track, there were these blended wing planes being developed as bombers as early as 1946 and onward. But only now have they got the technology in terms of construction and knowledge of aerodynamics, and particularly computerized controls, because making these planes fly stably and securely demands computers to make that work. And only now do they has this come together in this form and made it viable.
To the phones, to Matt in Champlin. Hi, Matt.
Yes, hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I have two questions. Hopefully they're both brief. The first is, with the design change in a blended wing aircraft, how will that change the way that we as passengers get on and off the airplane at airports? And my second question is maybe a little bit different. I'm just wondering, with fuel efficiency being so important, why haven't the passenger airline industry folks taken advantage of in-air refueling for passenger aircraft?
Okay.
Well, the first question is, it will look different. You'll enter a door, and instead of walking into a tube, you'll enter this, as I said, this theater-sized space, as you can see in the graphic in the magazine. Secondly, in-flight refueling would not be possible, because it is basically a very precarious operation. And the military does it all the time, but you wouldn't want to expose passenger airliners to that. The thing is to make the airliner as efficient as possible to fly long distances without that. There are planes now that can fly for 16 or 18 hours without a stop, and that's as long as anyone, I think, ever needs to stay seated in an airplane. By the way, when I talk about seats, I want to raise, this is a particular hobby horse of mine, the one part of the airplane that we all encounter most intimately, the seat, is the least developed part of the whole thing. I really have tried to wage a campaign about this. Think about how good the seats in cars have become, and now look at how bad the seats in airplanes are. Why isn't the same technology in the plane that's in the car?
Well, good point. Why is that?
Well, because they've always gone for the cheapest option and the crudest option, and only now I think people beginning to see that, again, with changes in materials and technology, that they could make far better seats. But I think it's outrageous, actually, that particularly in coach class, that the seats are representative of 1950s technology.
I just want to read what you've included with the illustration here about seats. You say, seats will be designed to create more room within the tight dimensions of coach. They'll be far lighter and more sculpted to the body with more recline. That'd be great. Also, staggering the seats in rows of three will enable an inside seat passenger easier access to the aisles. It's about time,
yeah,
Clive.
Yeah,
what have they been waiting for?
Well, you know, this goes to the whole question of why haven't they moved on all these issues before? And it's a bit like Detroit syndrome, is that as long as it worked, why change it?
And
only now with convergence of the two pressures, the cost of fuel and the environmental concerns, have they woken up and realized that this machine ought to and must be made far more friendly to the skies and also far more friendly to the passengers.
To Megan in Minneapolis. Hi, Megan.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I travel quite a lot between Minneapolis and Johannesburg, South Africa, and it's quite a long flight. And I was wondering if they had given any thought to sleepers on these new design planes.
Oh, well, there are sleepers on some planes already, and these flatbeds that you get now in business and first class. And I think Emirates, which is a very swish, very rich oil-empowered airline, which is flying the new large A380, has kind of private rooms, private suites in it with sleepers in. But, of course, that's going to cost you about $18,000 round-trip if you want to go to Dubai. I don't know why you'd particularly want to go to Dubai, but anyway, that you can go there in great comfort.
So Clive, in these designs, as I look at this illustration, it really does not look like there's that much more room for stretching out as our caller would like to do.
Well, the math is not going to change on that. It's very hard for airlines to make money in history. Making money out of an airline is very difficult, so cost pairing is always going to be with us.
To the phones, to Mary in Minneapolis. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hi. I live in South Minneapolis, not too far from the airport, and I'm wondering what kind of noise these airplanes will make.
Good question.
That's a very good question, and in fact, they're going to be a lot. They have to be, and they will be a lot quieter. The problem with that open rotor that I've got on the graphic is that initially, when they tested it, it was very noisy. It sounded like a buzzsaw. But now they've said that they can reduce the noise so much that it'll be about 20% or 30% quieter than the existing jet. Where the noise matters, of course, is right at the airport, because once it's up in the sky high and cruising, that's not an issue. So by regulation, by particularly severe European regulations, they're going to have to be much quieter on approach and much quieter on takeoff.
Clive, will these planes, these newly designed planes, fly at different altitudes, and would that solve some of what we were talking about in the first half about the limited airspace?
No, they won't fly at different altitudes, because basically the most efficient place to be is 35 to 40,000 feet, where the engine operates most efficiently. The problem with airspace, and I don't know what you discussed earlier, but the problem with airspace is that it doesn't need to be congested. It's just that there's so little of it made available. I mean,
yes.
For example, over the Thanksgiving weekend.
Right. We talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Opening up the military airspace.
Yeah.
They can do it.
Yeah. The sky, you know, the interesting thing, Kerry, is the skies are actually quite empty, apart from the sky around airports, which is where, like LaGuardia and Kennedy and Newark here in New York, which are, it's like a major logjam all day long. But otherwise, across the country and certainly across the world, the skies are basically remarkably empty. And with new technology, which could enable planes to fly closer together, there shouldn't be that kind of problem.
We have a comment here from Michelle in Minneapolis online, who says, I'd be very leery of flying without windows. When the plane turns, I need to find the horizon to avoid motion sickness. Well, that's one of the things that they would have to overcome as they introduce this new design, isn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And in fact, I asked people about that, and there's actually no way of simulating the effect of that until you actually do the test plane. But I went into it in some detail, and you might find that the blended wing is actually smoother in its maneuvers than a regular plane. For example, when you turn to approach a runway in a regular plane, you'll know that the plane banks a bit. It tilts one way or the other, and you look down out of the window. The blended wing does what's called a flat turn. It can turn without tipping its wing. So I think that would be a better flying experience. But I do have sympathy with this condition. It is a factor that they do have to weigh.
To Monica in Minneapolis. Hi, Monica.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am concerned about the air that you breathe in the airplane. Always have so many viruses, and I travel a lot with kids Okay. Nowhere, never enough space for them to stretch and everything. Are you guys doing something about that?
Quality of the air on the planes, Clive, are they thinking about that?
Yes, that's being well. In fact, the next Boeing, the 787 Dreamliner, will have a considerably improved circulation system, so you'll get much fresher air. One of the problems has been that the quality of the air varies according to where it is in the cabin, and usually it means that if you're sitting in the back, it's hot and stuffy, and if you're sitting in the front, it's nice and cool and comfortable. And they're greatly improving that by controlling the temperature in each zone of the plane rather than just letting it run around the plane. So I think, yes, you're going to see very much better. And also they're changing the this is a bit technical, I'll try to make it simple, the pressure in the plane at the moment is the equivalent of about 8,000 feet. And changes in technology will bring it down to about 6,000 feet, where it'll feel much more natural and far less dry, because obviously the lack of humidity in the airplane cabin is what dries out your skin and makes you feel parched.
I am curious about what's happening with the Dreamliner. It has been behind schedule. What's happening with it?
Well, I would call it the Nightmare Liner, not the Dreamliner at the moment, because it's a year and a half late. The problem is that Boeing decided quite bravely, I think, to do a lot of things they'd never done before all at once, which including using, instead of metal, using composites, and also offloading a lot of the work to very distant parts in the hope that this whole thing could be brought together in Seattle, clicked together like an airplane kit, and then rolled out of the hangar. And that hasn't worked out that way. There are a lot of glitches, and it's quite a mess at the moment. I'm quite sure that in the end it will be a magnificent plane, but it's been a kind of example of how not to approach innovation by doing too many things all in the same package at the same time.
At what point will some of us be flying on that Dreamliner? I mean, are there going to be enough purchase that we would see them in our domestic airlines here or what?
Yeah, it's a huge... Actually, although domestic airlines were very way behind foreign airlines in ordering it, they've sold, I think, about 800 now, and U.S. airlines are finally buying into it. And you should be able to fly in one in about 2 years' time, I should think.
Let me grab one last call here from Quint in Alexandria. Hi, Quint. Can you make it quick?
Yes, very quick.
Sure.
A radical redesign in airplanes seems to necessitate a radical redesign in airports. Is that something your guests could comment on?
Okay, good.
I think that so many airports are, like so many planes, very old and inefficient. But that is a piece of infrastructure which we need large numbers of dollars to fix. And let's hope that a cascade of dollars will now descend upon the bad airport.
Oh, yes. I'm sure that'll happen. Clive, I'll be keeping an eye out for anything else that you're writing for Condé Nast. I really appreciate the time this morning.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank
it was a you. Pleasure to be here.
Clive Irving is a senior consulting editor and travel writer for Condé Nast Traveler magazine. Now, if you'd like to read the article that he wrote. Actually, the title of it is Are You Ready? And it's got this picture of this very futuristic-looking plane on the lead page of this. We've linked the article and the photographs in the article to our mid-morning website. So if you happen to be at home or at work and you've got an opportunity to take a look at it, I'd suggest it's very interesting about what's happening at Boeing and some of the other airline manufacturers here as they look ahead to how we will travel by air in the year 2030 and beyond that. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to talk with neuroscientist and musician Daniel Levitin. He's written a fascinating new book with his arguing his theory about how music has shaped the evolution of the brain. Of course, if we're going to talk about music, we're going to listen to plenty of music, too. He's got some interesting theories about songs like White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane, Johnny Cash's I Walk the Line. Ought to be an interesting hour. Music and the way that the brain evolved with Daniel Levitin. That's at 10. If you want to take a look at the book real quick, you can find it on the Mid-Morning Book page at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. This is Mid-Morning.
Support for this program comes from the Lutheran Community Foundation, where charitable gifts can change lives and provide the donor with ongoing income during retirement. More on how to give and receive at the same time is online at LutheranCommunityFoundation.org.
Snuggle up with a brand new Lake Wobegon throw, featuring a map of the town with all of your favorite Lake Wobegon landmarks. You can order your Lake Wobegon throw from Pretty Good Goods at prettygoodgoods.org or by calling 1-800-998-8173.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.